The central theme of this week's episodes have been about shamanism and the many different aspects of shamanism. So for today's episode, I want to dive a little bit deeper into the life of the shaman. And of course, in order to do so, I'm going to bring in two fantastic thinkers from the modern era, two podcast favorites, Terence McKenna and Alan Watts. And we're going to see how they feel the path of the shaman relates to modern culture and maybe something that we've lost. Welcome to the Alchemical Mind. Before we get the episode started, of course, you know I have to talk about the Patreon at patreon.com/thealchemicalmind, where for just $1 a month, you can support this podcast and, of course, get additional content, early access to episodes, and best of all, the ad-free feed, so you don't have to listen to spots like this one or the upcoming ad. Join the others who are getting value out of listening to this podcast and supporting the show, like, for example, James, who asked that I plug his awesome band. Check out Czar Bomba on Spotify. There'll be a link in the show notes. And, of course, Michael Smith, both of them joining me at the $5 level. And, of course, the many others who support podcasts at every other tier, thank you so much for your support. Be sure to check out patreon.com/thealchemicalmind for more information, including all the great tiers available to you. Now, unlike some of the other episodes in which I kind of just play some of these lectures from famous thinkers, I want to actually dive a little bit deeper into this. So I'm going to begin with the lecture from Terence McKenna on shamanism and what it's about, and then I'm going to do some commentary. After that, we'll go ahead and get into Alan Watts and dive into his idea of what shamanic life is like, according to his own personal spiritual practice, mostly related to Buddhism and Eastern ideology. Without further ado, here's Terence McKenna.
The shaman, wherever and whenever he or she does their shamanizing, the shaman is a person who is able to transcend the dimensional confines of cultural existence. They know more than the people they serve. The people they serve are like children within the game of culture. Only the shaman knows that culture is a game. Everyone else takes it seriously. That's how he can do his magic. I was recently in Australia, and of course, Aboriginal culture and shamanism is a topic of great interest down there. And I learned, maybe some of you already knew this, that the term for shaman among English-speaking Aboriginals, of whom there are many, some who have spoken it for several hundred years, or over 100 years anyway, the term for shaman is simply clever fella. And if someone says, "I am a clever fella," they are making a professional claim of great weight. But I love that because it says it all. You know, a clever fella. When I was in the Amazon in my exploring days, we would go up these rivers to these bare-assed folks and to spend time with them. And the people would want to, you know, touch the outboard motors and look at your camera equipment and the butterfly nets and gather around, open-faced, totally innocent. You could always tell the shaman because, first of all, he usually didn't come out to see who was there, even though no one ever came. Even though these people had visitors once every 6 months, the guy who wouldn't come out of his hut for the only event in 6 months was inevitably the shaman. And when you met him, he wasn't interested in your Velcro or your break-apart, glow-in-the-dark little trinkets or any of the rest of it. He was looking straight at you through the eyes outside of culture, saying, "What kind of a person are you? Are you a fool or are you a clever fella? What is your measure? How much of the situation do you understand? How many levels are you simultaneously aware of at this moment?" And, you know, looking into the eyes of that sort of person, you either grow or turn away. You have not much choice. So what's happening with the shaman, I think, is he's a hands-on mathematician, a hands-on non-Euclidean geometer. The shaman enters into the quote-unquote chaos of the psychedelic experience, and sees that it is not chaos. It is hyperspace. And in it, the adumbrations of the trees of possibility can be followed. One can see who stole the eggs. One can see who cuckolded the chief's nephew. One can see who will die and who will live. One can see how the weather is going to change, and one can know where the game went. And this is not magic, not in that world. It's impossible in three-dimensional space and time. But in fourth-dimensional space and time, it not only is possible, it's inevitable and unavoidable. It's a different kind of way of being with the information.
Now, of course, there's a lot to unpack here, and as always, Terrence does kind of tend to go in the direction of psychedelic culture in terms of shamanism, and that's important, of course, because much of our philosophy and oral tradition and religious tradition does stem from this basic core of direct personal experience, and this is something that I dive into on the podcast quite a bit. Now, I love the fact that he mentions the Aboriginal tribes in Australia and their term for the shaman as the clever man. He calls it the clever fellow. And most commonly, I say today, would be called the clever man. And there's actually a show that's based in Australia in terms of diving into the concept of the clever man called, appropriately enough, the clever man. So I do recommend you check that out. It's kind of more of a, say, fantasy sci-fi type show. But there's some really interesting aspects to understanding the coevolution of Australian Aborigines with Western culture as that came into the subcontinent. So check that out if you will. But I love this idea of calling the shaman the clever man, because that's really ultimately what it falls into, right? Oftentimes I'm asked what my religion is, right? Because as I do this podcast, people are curious to know what my personal belief systems are. And I think I make that somewhat clear in the discussions that I have on the show, even when I dive into particular aspects of religion and philosophy that I don't always agree with. And that'll become a little more evident in the coming week as I begin my dive into Zoroastrianism. Because even though Zoroastrianism is a beautiful religion and obviously extremely influential, there's a lot of things that I don't particularly agree with in terms of the overall philosophy, the way that the rituals have developed. See, for me, spirituality is something akin to what you would consider maybe the pathless path, right? And this dives into what Terrence was talking about in terms of this idea of the clever man, where you realize the inherent magic in all the things that you see around you. And not magic, of course, in the Harry Potter sense or any of these fantasy shows or books or movies that you might find in popular culture, but magic in just how incredible it is that things arise in the way that they arise. Now, I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into this next week. I'm going to do a listener episode because I have some really interesting discussions with listeners on Twitter and on the Discord. So check those out if you haven't yet, at Mind Alchemical. And there's a link to the Discord on the website, thealchemicalmind.com. And we often have these kinds of much deeper discussions and to try to understand what the magic is all about. Because you see, for me, the world is inherently magical, but not in the fact that you say some incantation, you string a string of words together to create a spell, but in the fact that everything is magic at the core. And if you're able to see this magical aspect of reality, you realize how simple and mundane it is. And I've talked about this quite a bit in terms of how dogma arises in religion and philosophy, and of course, including even in science. And it's important to remember this aspect. Because you see, at the core of these traditions lies what the true aspect of magic is. And that is in realizing the simplicity of things. You see, we often tend to overcomplicate our existence. We try to find meaning in other things, in actions, in professions, in relationships. And that's not what you see in a natural state. Animals don't ever think about what their job is for today. They just go ahead and continue existing and experiencing the magic that is reality. And see, the shaman is able to do this because they are able to drop all these opinions. Now, in terms of Terence, a lot of these opinions can be dropped through the use of psychedelics and undergoing mystical experience through the use of these substances. Now, Alan Watts has a slightly different take, and he is actually going to be diving into the aspect of shamanic life in terms of Hindu tradition. Because the Hindus have a really interesting system in terms of their society, in which some of these aspects of hunter-gatherer cultures that thrived on the shamanic lifestyle have persisted throughout the centuries and millennia, even though the culture that Alan Watts will be talking about is a settled agrarian culture, as opposed to what Terence was just talking about, which is more of a traditional hunter-gatherer society. And you see, in hunter-gatherer societies, everybody can be a shaman, because everybody has a piece of their culture directly entwined with their own personal sense of identity, right? There's no sense of ego in the way that we see it. There is a separate self from the rest of the group, but see, that thing is directly tied into the group. So at any point, any member of the tribe can kind of disappear, and that doesn't mean that the culture disappears, because every single member of the tribe possesses all the knowledge inside of them to continue the tribe. If you want to take a scientific example, this is what we would see in things like DNA, right? Regardless of how many people die, as long as you have a population that can kind of keep making babies, if you will, the human race would continue, or any particular species would continue. In our current settled agrarian style society, and of course it's evolved quite a bit beyond that into specialization, this is not always the case. And those of you familiar with things like the Younger Dryas hypothesis and things like that, the work of Graham Hancock, will be very familiar with this, in which Graham talks about this cataclysmic event and why we don't see these advanced cultures anymore. Well, the reason is very simple. If you have a very advanced society, that society becomes very specialized. And so people only have specific aspects of the culture inside of them, and they can move that particular aspect forward. But you see, in hunter-gatherer cultures, you don't have this. Everyone has every piece of the culture, and so that culture can continue. So let's see what Alan Watts has to say about this topic.
A Buddhist monk is sometimes called a shramana. S-R-A-M-A-N-A, shramana. This is closely allied to the word shaman. And a shaman is the holy man in a culture that is still hunting. It isn't settled, it isn't agrarian. There is a very strong and important difference between a shaman and a priest. A priest receives his ordination from his superiors. He receives something from a tradition which is handed down. A shaman doesn't. He receives his enlightenment by going off into the forest by himself, to be completely alone. A shaman is a man, in other words, who has undergone solitariness. He's gone away into the forest to find out who he really is, because it's very difficult to find that out while you're with other people. And the reason is that other people are busy all the time telling you who you are, in many, many ways, by the laws they impose on you, by the behavior ruts they set on you, by the things they tell you, by the fact that they always call you by your name, and by the fact that when you live among people, you have to be in a state of ceaseless chatter. But if you want to find out who you are before your father and mother conceived you, who you really are, you almost have to go off by yourself. And go into the forest and stop talking, even stop thinking words, and be absolutely alone, and listen to the great silences. And then, if you're lucky, you recover from the illusion that you're just little me, the so-and-so, and you attain the state of nirvana, which means the blown-out state, the relieved state, the sigh of relief. Nirvana may be translated into English as, "Phew, I've at last discovered that I don't have to survive. I can survive, of course, but I don't really have to." Because you discover, you see, that what you really are doesn't have to survive, because it's what there is. The real you is it, or that, tat tvam asi, that art thou, as the Hindus say. So then, in the normal life of India, which is not a hunting culture, but a settled culture, there are priests, but there is something beyond the priest. That is to say, when a man or woman has fulfilled his or her life in the world of society, it's the normal thing to do for a person to quit their status in society and become what's called a forest dweller. That is almost, you see, to go back to the hunting culture. They divide people into two classes, Grihastha, which means householder, and Vanaprastha, which means forest dweller. And the older people all hand over their occupations and positions to their children and enter the stage of Vanaprastha, or become a Shramana, and go outside the stockade. I'm speaking metaphorically. They sometimes do, actually. They sometimes don't. And become a nobody. They give up their name. That is to say, the label which designates who they are in terms of caste or class. They become unclassified people. That's why, strictly speaking, you see, Hinduism and Buddhism are not religions. You can classify the religions. You can say, what's your denomination? Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Quaker, etc., 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 you see. But strictly speaking, a Vanaprastha, a Shramana, has no label. He is an unlabeled bottle. So, in the time when the Buddha lived, about 600 BC, the Hindu system had become somewhat decadent. It isn't altogether clear what had happened to it, but it is certain that it did seem in some way to be in need of reform. And so, there were many reasons for this. And the Buddha, as a young man, being basically troubled by the great problems that we're all troubled with, the problem of suffering, and the problem of what all this universe is about, he endeavored to follow the methods that were then being used by people who were shramanas or vanaprasthas, forest dwellers. And at that time, it's very apparent that the main method that these people were using was an ascetic discipline. Starvation, very arduous meditation practices, probably self-flagellation, and things of that kind. And it's said that for 7 years he practiced these austerities. But he found out that they didn't lead to liberation. And all the people who were practicing them knew they didn't either. But they felt that that was only because they weren't doing it hard enough. And so he propounded instead the middle way. The way that led to liberation from the rat race that I've drawn here, neither through austerities nor through pleasure-seeking. See, these are the two ways, the two paths. The people who say the whole point of life is to enjoy it, to get the most out of it, you see. And the other people who tried that and then they found it was sour grapes or something, you know, or they burned their fingers in the pursuit of pleasure. The girl that was so beautiful eventually fell apart or just turned into a shrew and whatever it was. And so they said, instead, let us torment ourselves. A lot of people enjoy this, or get something special out of it. I was in Mexico this summer, and what I went there for was to study Mexican Catholicism, where they make a great cult of suffering. And I was very puzzled about this and wanted to understand it. And everywhere, you know, they have these ghastly, tormented Christs, all drooling with blood, hanging on crosses in very contorted positions. And I realized there are certain people who find that the sitting on the tip of a spike is the realest place in the world. Because when you're on the tip of a spike, you know you're there. There's no doubt about it. And also you know that you're expiating for everything. This, somehow by sitting on the spike, you are paying for your guilt. And so long as you hurt, you're all right. See? So these shramanas were doing something of the same kind. And the Buddha became enlightened. Became a Buddha. He woke up. At the moment when he gave up that kind of quest.
Now again, there's a lot to unwrap here because Alan Watts' take on shamanism is slightly different, although very much tangentially related, as should become obvious from the discussion. Now his point of view comes from kind of a Buddhist ideology, and the Buddhists have, of course, this idea of people that go out into the forest to achieve some sort of enlightenment. And then you have the idea of the bodhisattva, which is somebody that goes out, achieves enlightenment, and then returns to society in order to share that knowledge. And see, in many respects, this is very similar to what Terence was talking about. Because for traditional cultures, indigenous cultures throughout the world, this is kind of the purpose of the shaman. The shaman does oftentimes live apart from society, but they're very much intertwined with society. And part of their purpose is to share knowledge, to be able to commune with the spirits, to be able to commune with the other realms that exist in our universe, and share that knowledge with those that kind of don't want to partake in that journey. Now see, for some, this journey is kind of inherent, and I've had this discussion with many listeners that feel that they are part of this journey, that they feel like inherently they should have been born a shaman, say, at some point in time. And I find this type of curiosity very interesting, of course, because this is one of the motivations that led me and drove me to create this podcast, this kind of quest for truth and knowledge. And of course, the deeper and deeper I dive into my own personal quest and my own personal attainment of some sort of gnosis, if you will, the more I realize that things aren't as complicated as sometimes you read in books or listen to podcasts. And see, this goes back to the aspect of the clever man, the person that's able to discern the magic from the reality, and that maybe the two are very tightly, intricately intertwined. So you see, the shaman is able to see the world for what it really is, but that journey has to begin somewhere, and the journey oftentimes has to begin with doing the self-introspection, the self-inquiry work, the reading of books, the taking of psychedelics, the doing of meditations, the performance of prayers. You have to begin in somewhere, right? You have to gather the set of instructions from someplace. Now, there are, of course, many people who are fortunate enough that they don't have to perform a lot of these rituals in order to attain this sort of gnosis themselves. They're able to directly commune with the world around them, with nature, with the universe, with an ultimate reality, maybe sometimes get a download of information, and be able to kind of revel in that knowledge. Now, this is when you have to be careful, of course, because as Alan Watts was talking about, the Buddha realized that there was something inherently wrong, if you will, with the system. Because for hundreds or thousands of years, people had been going out into the woods and trying to perform these rituals to achieve some sort of awakening experience, and many of them didn't. And the reason why they felt like maybe they weren't getting to that place was that they weren't doing the practice hard enough. And see, I talked about this recently, in particular with the episode that I did on fear. So go check out episode 50, Fear is the Mind Killer, and of course some of the subsequent discussions. Because one thing I realized with my, you know, somewhat recurrent trips out into the woods, or even just going out into my backyard, I'm fortunate enough to have a good bit of nature surrounding me, and there is kind of a forest and a swamp behind my property, so I'm able to go out and kind of commune a little bit with the natural world. Not everyone has this privilege, if you will, right? The majority of people in modern society live in cities, so maybe all you have around you are buildings and homes, and you actually have to go somewhere in order to commune with nature. You might need to go to some kind of public park, or you might need to go out to a national park or a national forest, or some other hiking activity, for example. But not everyone has this, but it's important to have these experiences, you see, because through having that direct experience is when you're able to achieve this real gnosis, this awakening, this ability to drop illusions. Now be very careful, of course, because as you begin dropping illusions, you will naturally be jaded by the things that you've been raised to believe. So this is another aspect of life as a shaman, of finding this awakening, of finding your purpose, is being able to discern how much of the things that you learn from communing with nature or God actually stem from that communion and not simply some sort of fallacy that you create for yourself because now you feel like you've achieved some sort of enlightenment experience. I listen to a lot of podcasts and I hear this kind of thing all the time. In fact, I was listening to one last night in which the guy kept on talking about his awakening experience, but then some of the things that he was basing his evidence on for being awakened seemed very much ego-driven. And so we have to be careful with this, right? When you start hearing people talking about being reincarnations of Thoth or Cleopatra or, you know, anybody. What's the one, Edgar Casey? There's a lot going on with reincarnations of Edgar Casey. You have to be very careful with these things, right? I'm not saying that you can't reincarnate as somebody else, but as I mentioned in the episode that's going to be coming out next week with Anthony Tyler, isn't it curious that everybody that's kind of resurrected from somebody else, right, recalling some past life experience, is always somebody very important, king or a priest or a philosopher or something like this? Why is that the case? Is it simply because you identify with that person? Are you actually reincarnated from there, or is there something kind of deeper that you have to go into? So you need to always be truthful and honest with yourself, and this is how you know you achieve a true shamanic experience, a true mystical awakening, you see, that you can go and drop all your opinions and everything that you've been taught, regardless of what system you came from. It's very important to do so. And as Alan Watts said, it is important to go out into the woods. And of course, you know, if you want to take this in a more modern sense, it is important to read books and to study and to meditate and to ponder and to do thought experiments. All that is part of the process. But you see, through doing these practices, you can come to a place in your practice where you no longer need those things, right? Where these things end up becoming self-evident. Now, how you determine whether you're being deluded or whether you're actually finding some sort of gnosis is kind of a deeper topic and something that we'll have to get to at some other point in the future. But do check out the series of episodes that I did on epistemology, roughly concurrent with the gnosis lectures and the Gnostic sect lectures, because they are intricately entwined, right? You have to be able to discern what is true with a capital T from true with a lowercase t. You see, these two things are different. And that's why I did the episode on understanding belief versus faith versus gnosis, because there's a very thin line that you tow back and forth between these two things. You see, finding true gnosis, some awakening, enlightening, communion with God, union with God, is kind of a pendulum, right? It's not a path where you're going up the mountain and you get to the top of the mountain and you achieve this thing. That's not the way that it works. It's a beautiful metaphor, of course, and it works. It's very clear. But see, if you lack the understanding, you feel like once you get to the top of the mountain, that you are it. But see, that's not the case. Knowing that you are it involves going back and forth between knowing and unknowing, and finding some place in the middle where you can reside. That's why I like the idea of the pendulum much better. Of course, the idea of the pendulum may not be as attractive to many people because people want to feel like they can achieve a mystical experience, or they can achieve ultimate enlightenment. But see, we always end up going back to this idea that the wise man knows he knows nothing. And that is when you truly achieve the life of a shaman. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode of The Alchemical Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to leave me a comment on Twitter at Mind Alchemical. You can send me an email, Martin at The Alchemical Mind. Check out the website, thealchemicalmind.com, with links to everywhere where you can subscribe, to the Patreon, to the Discord channel, where we have some really awesome discussions. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode. As always, remember that you are it.